This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, in for Terry Gross. We're going to start today's show by remembering Melvin Van Peebles. He died last week at age 89. His death was announced by his son, actor and director Mario Van Peebles. We'll hear from him later in the show. Melvin Van Peebles is best known for his 1971 film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which he wrote, directed, scored, produced, and starred in. He played Sweetback, a young black man in L.A. who was on the run after a violent altercation with police, trying to save the life of a Black Panther who was being beaten by two white LAPD cops. It was dedicated to, quote, all the black brothers and sisters who have had enough of the man, unquote. Although the film's success helped open the door to Hollywood for other black filmmakers, Van Peebles never quite walked through that door himself. After Sweetback, Van Peebles left filmmaking. He produced two Broadway shows, wrote for television, worked as a Wall Street trader, and wrote a book about stock options. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1990 and asked why he cast himself in the starring role as Sweetback.
Well, number of reasons. First, I needed someone with a large understanding of cinema who had a number of years of experience in it, and the people that had that number of years of experience in the cinema generally were not of the street ilk that I needed, one. Two, those that were wanted him to have more lines. He said 6 lines in the whole movie. And they had been taught that lines equal a size of film, a size of a part. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm, sure do.
Since I didn't want him to talk a lot. He didn't have to talk a lot. And that's why I did it.
There were a couple of weeks when Sweetback outdid Love Story at the box office, which is pretty extraordinary considering it was an independently produced film. How did you independently get that kind of distribution?
Well, I didn't independently get that kind of distribution. What I simply did was make a good movie. Only 2 theaters in the United States would show it. 2 theaters at all would show the movie. And they did so well, then everybody called me. And at that stage of the game, hey, it was their turn in the barrel. I made deals, and the audience went to see it. That's how that happened.
Your film, Sweetback, was considered to be the first of the blaxploitation films. What you did was you took the action genre and put it into a black politicized context. And I'd really be interested in hearing what gave you the idea to do that.
Well, being alive really gave me the idea of doing it. I just got my original reason for going into films was that I had gotten tired of seeing blacks portrayed in an image that I didn't agree with. And so I said, gee, I can do better than that. And if you don't control your images, then you don't have a base for controlling your destiny. So I wanted to control how I was perceived, and therefore I went into films. Now, you said something very interesting when you said that the film was the first blaxploitation film. It was not really the blaxploitation film. It started blaxploitation, which took out the political content and just kept the action and the winning black person. In fact, the revolutionary aspect of Sweetback was put at 180-degree turn and became almost an apology for the man. Up until that time, there had really been no black movies that mirrored the ethos, the wants and the desires of the lumpen proletariat, the urban proletariat. And that's what Sweetback did.
Well, you're talking about wanting to make movies that had an image that you believed in. Now, Sweetback was praised by a lot of people for being a black film, you know, made by blacks, starring blacks, set in the black community. On the other hand, it was criticized by many people within the black community for having its hero be the real stud. And some people saw that as perpetuating a stereotype instead of shattering it. And I wonder what you thought of those criticisms and what you think of them now in retrospect.
Well, I thought that Jesus Christ was nothing but a carpenter in his own hometown, and so it really didn't bother me too much. I think that's completely valid, what they said, and I disagree with it 100%. That is, you can have, you can take a stereotype, and you don't have to run from it. You can take it to the other side and throw it back, a la jujitsu, and use that stereotype as the impetus for your force. You see, I could have taken Sweetback and had him a college professor, but that didn't, that was not the situation of the people that I wanted to talk to, the large group of people that I wanted to talk to. I took Sweetback from, let's say, one of the lowest possible common denominators in the community and therefore moved him forward. I didn't move him forward from some elevated period or position in the community from the first place, whereas the people once again left out in the cold. It wasn't somebody that they knew. That's why I felt that the audience reacted so positively, the major audience, the much of the intelligentsia or many of the cultural nationalists did not like that move. Well, that's that is a valid point of view. It doesn't happen to be my own.
You were one of the first, or perhaps the first, black director of a feature film, feature-length film.
Well, I was probably the first of a commercial feature film outside of, after Oscar Michaud went out of business in around 1932 with the, really with the advent of sound, he had to phase out. I came back to the States in 1967 as one of the French delegates to the San Francisco Film Festival. No one knew I was an American, let alone black. And I had lived in Europe for many years, and I was a French journalist and then writer. And there was a law that a French writer can have a director's card to direct his own work. So one of my novels I turned into a film. Film script, and that's how I got a French director's card, and that's how the film was made in France.
So you started your film career in France?
No, I didn't start making movies in France. I made movies in San Francisco when I used to drive a cable car many years ago.
Oh, I see. So you'd made like small, short, independent films.
I made short, independent films, and I went to Hollywood with my films, and I said, here are my films, here's some of my work, I've written the story, etc., and I'd like a job. And they offered me a job as an elevator operator. I said, no, you don't understand. I'd like to write. I'd like to direct. Then they offered me a job as a tap dancer or a dancer. You know, I said, hey, guys, that's not what I had in mind. And then they explained to me that one day my people might learn to operate this complicated equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And the rainfall at Kilimanjaro was this, that, and the other, you know. And I was at that juncture. I left America.
And you went to France?
No, I went to Holland to get my PhD in astronomy. I used to be an astronomer. And however, those early first films I made were seen in France. Henri Langlois, who started really the first cinema museum, the Cinémathèque Française, declared me a genius and looked me up. And I was living in Holland at the time and said I should be making films. Well, once he called me a genius, I said, finally, there's somebody who understands me.
So you don't think it would have been possible to start your career as a director had you just stayed in America?
What do I know? I mean, it didn't seem that it was burgeoning with opportunity at the time.
Uh-huh. You ended up leaving movies to work on Wall Street. You were probably, when you started on Wall Street, one of the few black traders with a seat on the exchange.
I was the only black trader on the American Stock Exchange at the time I started there. There were, I think, five brokers. Now, a broker is different than a trader. A broker works on the commission and he execute orders for others. A trader executes from his own, for his account or his own company's account, and he does not work on a commission.
So what was it like being the only black trader on the exchange?
Well, I've been in a number of other situations. I was the first black Eagle Scout in the Pohegan Trails. I was the first first black navigator in my squadron. I was the first black and out of ROTC in my college. You know, on and on and on and on, on again. It was not particularly disconcerting to me.
In your new book, No Identity Crisis, your son Mario, with tongue-in-cheek, calls you his lizard dad.
Right.
It talks about you as being the person who really lacks diplomacy when it comes to, dealing with somebody.
I gave it the office. My diplomacy was worn away a few years ago. Well, a long time ago.
Did you ever have any?
I can't remember back that far. That's very unfair. How do I know? As I look back, I don't think that was one of my strong points.
Melvin Van Peebles speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. He died last week at age 89. Next, we're going to hear from actor and director Mario Van Peebles, the son of filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles, who died last week. Mario Van Peebles made his directorial debut with the 1991 movie New Jack City, in which he also co-starred. He also played Malcolm X in the film Ali and directed Panther, a film about the Black Panther Party. He made his movie debut when he was a boy in his father's 1971 film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. More than 30 years later, Mario wrote and directed Badass, a movie about the making of his father's 1971 groundbreaking film. That was the occasion of his interview with Terry. He starred in the film in the role of his father, Melvin. Here's Mario as his father in a scene from the film. Melvin's agent is trying to negotiate a 3-picture deal with the studio. The studio wants a follow-up to his film Watermelon Man, one that doesn't have anything to do with Sweetback. The agent is played by Saul Rubinek.
This idea I got is kind of like a ghetto western. In fact, the brother even wears like a black kind of cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And dig this, man, at the end of the movie, when he gets away, words come blazing across the screen. Badass nigga's gonna come back and collect some dues.
You lost your mommy. Are you taking drugs now?
Listen to me. Melvin, listen to me. On Watermelon Man, your white lead is supposed to wake up from this nightmare where he's a black guy and turn back into being white again. You said, no, being black is not a nightmare, and you didn't shoot the ending the studio wanted. Who backed you 100%? So why are you doing this to me? I can't take this kind of inflammatory to a major studio. Nobody legitimate is going to talk badass. No one! You know how hard we worked to get here? Melvin, just do the comedy, okay? All right, look, they're coming here. Listen, you know what this is? You're terrified you're going to fail, so you're failing yourself. Nothing to do with being black or blue or green. You hear me? It's self-destruction. Hey, Marty. Alan! How you doing? So, listen.
Now, why did you want to make a film about the making of the film?
Yeah, great. That's a good idea. Well, you know, it was an interesting process for me. Why did I make Badass? And I was on the set of Ali and being directed by Michael Mann. And we had these great sort of political discussions. And Michael is a real historian. And, of course, Ali is there himself. And I started to think about the notion, if Ali were, you know, one of the first athletes to use the ring, not just to box, but to stand for something, then Melvin Van Peebles was one of the first filmmakers to use the silver screen, not just to entertain us, but to stand for something, to say, we no longer want to be depicted as butlers and maids or as uber Negroes trying to fit in and guess who's coming to dinner. That's fine. It's got its place. But there's also a place for folks, black folks in cinema that do live to the end, that do have a sexuality, that are empowered and are not just sort of dealing with the oppressor. And so I thought, no, I'll go see my dad. My dad's got a great book on the making of Sweetback. And my dad said, yeah, I love you. If you want the book, I don't want to get screwed on the deal. You have to option it and pay for it like everybody else. And if you play me or whoever plays me, don't make me too damn nice. And as you saw in the movie Badass, I didn't sugarcoat him. He is who he is.
Now, you were 12 years old when your father was making Sweet Sweetback?
Yeah, 12 going on 13.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a small, famous or infamous part in Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. I want you to describe the scene that you're in.
Well, actually, I'm in two scenes.
One, you know the scene I want people, you to describe.
People tend to remember more than others. Yeah. I blew up a car where I did keep my afro. And the other scene is the beginning of the movie where I play, ironically, Sweetback as a kid. So I'm playing my dad's character as a kid, and now in Badass, I'm playing my dad as an adult. But in the Sweetback scene as a kid, you see how Sweetback gets his name. And Sweetback was an old sort of blues term about a guy that was good at making love. And so as a kid, he gets initiated with this prostitute in a brothel. And I play the kid in that scene. And then it turns into my dad. Playing Sweetback, I often tease him that I'd like another crack at the role now. But, but you know, at the time, I didn't want to... There was a number, I didn't want to be working with him on the movie after a while. I thought my dad and I didn't always get along. I would never put my kids in a scene like this. But I came to understand him differently as a man, you know, walking in those shoes.
Well, in 1990, I interviewed your father, and I asked him about why he cast you in that scene. And I want to play you that part of the interview. It'll just take a minute. So here it is, a 1990 interview with Melvin Van Peebles, who is the father of my guest, Mario Van Peebles. Sweetback, the movie opens with a 10-year-old Sweetback finding a home for himself in a whorehouse and having his sexual initiation with a 40-year-old woman. And it's a fairly explicitly done scene. They're both nude. He's in between her legs. And this is your son in that role, your 10-year-old son. I was astonished when I found out it was your son. What made you decide to cast him in that part?
Well, one, he tends to look like me, being my
right.
son and all.
Yeah.
And what I always found very interesting was people saying, but it's your son. But every child is someone's son, and I wouldn't ask my son or myself to do anything that I wouldn't ask of anyone else's child. I don't have that differentiation of, well, it's mine, and therefore it cannot be.
Let me just ask you, how much did your son know about sex when that scene was shot? I mean, did he get what was happening?
Well, let me put it this way. He wanted a bicycle for Christmas, so he didn't have a lot of leverage. And I didn't ask him, actually. Well, he did say something rather funny, though. He said, Dad, is this going to be an X movie? I said, yes. He said, phew, oh, I don't want the kids at school to see me.
Okay, so that's Melvin Van Peebles, recorded in 1990. Mario, what did you think of his answer that he wouldn't have asked his son to do anything that he wouldn't have asked anyone else's son to do, and he wouldn't have asked anyone else's son to do something that he couldn't ask his own son to do?
You know what? I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't want to be in that scene. I didn't want to have to give that lovely bike back. That bike had a banana seat. And I didn't want to get my afro cut. Luckily, I got to keep my, you know, afro intact.
One of the things your father mentioned when I was talking to him is that you asked how the movie would be rated, and you were relieved when it was X, when he told you it would be X-rated because you didn't want your friends to see you nude in that scene. Did your friends
right.
see you in the scene?
A couple of them did, and then I got a lot of date calls.
Oh, really? So it worked in your favor.
Like I said, I wouldn't mind another shot now. He said, well, I am not giving another shot. I had to fill in for you last time.
Now you were in the position, I mean, you not only like play your father in Badass, but you were in your father's position of having to cast a boy to play the role that your father made you play when he was making his film. So how did you cast for it? Who did you choose, and how explicit did you want to make your version of his scene?
Well, I thought I didn't want to make anyone do that scene twice, so in Badass, I just used the original footage of me as a kid in Sweetback during that scene. So the kid I cast wasn't going to have to do anything like that. And that's just something that I wanted to do. I'm not going to repeat, you know, do unto someone else what I didn't like done unto me. But I did want to show the scene because I thought it was a point in my life. And it just showed something interesting about Melvin, that he was sort of like that great Santini-esque father, almost that which does not kill you in a Nietzsche-esque way makes you stronger. And if I bounce this basketball off your head a little bit, well, you'll be tough and you'll know how to deal. And, you know, so he has his whole philosophy. And, you know, I'm a filmmaker and I've benefited from him, you know, knocking down the doors he knocked down. Absolutely.
Did your father charge you a lot of money for rights to use the scene in your film?
That's a good question. This guy is a trip, man. So I go to my dad. I say, okay, now listen, I got the movie funded. So I go to see my old man about because I wanted to put some clips of his film Sweetback in my film Badass. And he said, great, great. Yeah, just tell me the scenes you want and I'll put them up and you can pay for them. I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is product placement. People will see Badass and want to see Sweetback. What are you talking about? This is product placement. He goes, no, you got to pay for them just like anybody else. So sure enough, I wound up writing him a check. I think it was for $2,500 and giving it to him, which he promptly cashed. And then he turned around and said, by the way, I want to take you and all your Badass kids on vacation. And he wound up spending about $5,000 to take us on this lovely vacation on an island in Guana and take my sister and her kids as well. So he's a funny dude because in one hand he's doing the business deal with his son and he's, you know, taking the money on and in the other pocket he's putting twice as much back. But that's Melvin Van Movies.
I think the way you play your father in your movie Badass kind of walks the line between obsessively adhering to his artistic vision and being selfish, and walks the line between being confident and arrogant. I thought that seemed not knowing him, that seemed to have a ring of truth to it. How did you see him when you were 12 and he was making the movie? Did you see him as confident or arrogant? Did you see him as selfish?
You know, I don't know that as 12 I analyzed it.
And when I say selfish, I mean because he was putting a lot of family kind of interests on the back burner to make this movie. He was
totally
losing
obsessed,
money.
Yes.
He was totally obsessed. He was losing money.
Single vision, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, he's a driven cat. And, you know, there's that scene in Badass where he says to Big T, Big T is, the crew has spent a weekend in jail. And Big T, who's the big, you know, muscled sound man is really pissed by this. And my dad has that scene where he says, look, you know, this is bigger than you. I got all my stuff on the line and all my family stuff. This is a war. It's our war to take back our imagery. We'll not be butlers. We won't be shuffling. It's bigger than you. It's bigger than me. And if you don't know that, then quit. You know, and if you're going to say you're going to kick my ass, do it. And if I was afraid of you, I wouldn't be the kind of brother to get this thing done. And that's very much my pop, and he's still that way to this day. What he believes in, he stands for, and I respect that. And he made changes. I wouldn't have been able to get Badass done the same way. I mean, now, 30 years later, I could get a union crew that was multiracial, where there were women on the crew, there were Asians on the crew. My DP was a 63-year young Jewish brother, and my Asian set decorator and designer and the young sister with the fro who did the wardrobe. I could get, because my dad had broken the unions and made sure that these people could work. I directed a film called New Jack City in 1991-90, and the guy that came to me who was my producer, Preston Holmes, said, you know how I got my job? I said, how? He said, because your dad was willing to get fired so that all of us could come on as crew. And he did get fired. He insisted we stay. And that's how I got my job. And so I look at the changes he made. And I'm like, wow, I don't know if I'd have the freedom I do now as a filmmaker had I not had, you know, this dad who was willing to pay the cost to be the godfather of soul cinema.
I know actors often feel that when they put on the costumes, you know, or the wardrobe for a movie, that they are transformed by those clothes. Now, in your case, you were wearing what I imagine were clothes very similar to what you remembered your father wearing when your father made Sweet Sweetback. So how did you feel in those clothes, saying the things you remembered your father saying and doing your best to become him? Could you just, like, talk about what that felt like?
Oh, to play your father, making a film that you remember him making, and you were on that set. I had some of the very same clothes that he wore. That sort of pimpy, crushed velvet, gold, obnoxious outfit, for example. I don't know where he got that outfit. That thing was horrendous. Anyway, I had them get me another outfit and make me an outfit like that. And we were shooting a scene in L.A. in the hood. Since it was an independent film and I only had 18 days to make the movie, I used my own truck. See, that was my camera vehicle. So I had my truck and I had the DP stick the camera out the window. He hadn't been to the hood, so he was like, he's a little nervous. He's sticking the camera out the window. I said, okay, here's the deal. We don't have permits for any of this. I'm going to walk on the other side of the street. And when I signal you, I'm going to run through the ghetto. And you photograph me, but we're only getting one shot at it because the second time I run through, they're going to recognize me. So I got on the Mac Pimp Daddy suit. I got the mustache just like Dad. And I signal him. He starts driving the truck. They're shooting out the window. And I run past these old cats in the hood. One brother's looked up. He's been drinking Ripple on that same corner for like 90 years. And the guy looks up and he sees me running and he goes, "Sweetback's back. He came back. The brother came back just like he said he came back." It was surreal. We went to the very same places my dad went in the ghetto because he was avoiding the unions, and in the desert because the unions couldn't find him and they were scared to go in the hood. And we went to the same locations and did the same stuff. I mean, 33 years later. In fact, we even shot on the very street he lived on, his office was on.
You know how no matter how much you love somebody, they often have, like, a certain gesture that really gets on your nerves? I'm wondering if your father had something like that that you had to recreate when you were playing him.
Yeah, I did. There are many things. One is he eats with his fingers. And what he does is he says he doesn't want to eat anything. He likes to stay nice and slim. He's got a great stomach. He's, you know, he can still outrun me. He's 71 years old. He's a bad brother. But how he does that is psychologically, he's understood that what he doesn't order won't make him fat. So he encourages you to order something. He gets a mere salad or whatever. And then he'll reach over and put his fingers right into your food and sort of smack it up. The second thing is, growing up with my dad was like growing up if you're a woman and you grew up with Margaret Thatcher as your mother, whether you agree with mommy's politics or not, whether you agree with her politics, it would be very hard for men to convince you that a woman could have no place in the old boy network of politics. Growing up with my dad, who did speak French, who did speak Dutch, who was one of the first black officers in the Air Force, was never on drugs, was never in jail, didn't play basketball, and didn't rap, was liberating because I thought it's all possible. And that was the biggest gift, was that I saw the possibilities of what one could do.
Well, Mario Von Peebles, thank you so much for talking with us.
I love talking with you and would, you know, do it anytime. Green eggs and ham, anywhere, on a boat, on a moat, in Philly, wherever.
Mario Von Peebles speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His father, filmmaker Melvin Von Peebles, died last week at age 89.